Welcome to the Water of the Word, the radio ministry of Pastor Steve Hadley at Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. May the Lord inspire, encourage, and direct you today. May you be transformed and refreshed by the Water of the Word.
Make your way over to the book of 1 Timothy chapter 2. Put our first line up there. Go ahead. It's a beautiful document, you guys. We have a copy of it out here in our lobby because it's pretty important. That's the Declaration of Independence. But before we look there, would you look here? 1 Timothy chapter 2. It is our custom here at Harvest to go through the scriptures verse by verse, chapter by chapter, and book by book. But every once in a while, we'll take a Sunday or Wednesday and we'll talk about some stuff. The Lord God says to us, oh, I love you so much. And I really want you to be able to love me. I'm not tough to find. I'm not jumped through 55 hoops and, 45 calisthenics of one theological nature or another. Here's what he says. I want you to love me with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Today will be an exercise in exercising our brains. Hats off to you teachers out there. Thank you, thank you, thank you, you teachers. You're watching this online. Oh, you have quite a job in front of you. I wouldn't say you're quite handcuffed talking about Jesus Christ and the beauty of God's word, but it's not easy, is it? Well, today I'm going to give you a bit of a civics lesson, but let's start with 1 Timothy chapter 2 and understand our scriptural basis for it. 1 Timothy 2, verse 1, therefore I exalt first of all that supplications and prayers and intercessions and thanksgiving be made for all men, for kings. Now, this is about the time when, guess who was emperor of Rome? Nero. What a freak show he was. Who is in authority over you? God has seen to it. What are we supposed to do if your candidate doesn't get elected? You're supposed to frump and cut him down whenever you get the shot. No. Pray for them, for kings. And all, everybody say all. It says so right there. All who are in authority. Why? That we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. We have a special guest speaker this morning. We couldn't fly him in and put him up in a hotel, so we snagged him on video. I hope you don't mind. David Barton of Wall Builders. He has over 100,000 artifacts, letters, and books, and Bibles, and pamphlets. Over 100,000 original documents and autographs. If you haven't been in school in a while, especially around 4th, 5th, and 6th grade, the teaching curriculum these days, when it comes to history, especially of these United States, is not what it once used to be. The pilgrims, our millennials know little about, and certainly to the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. And so everybody knows that's the foundational document right there. That's July the 2nd, actually. Our next slide, please. There are some of the names. John Hancock, of course, is one of the most prominent signatures. How many of you know about John Hancock? A lot of us don't. He would eventually become the governor of Massachusetts. And as governor, 21 times in his tenure, he called for the entire state of Massachusetts, all shops to be closed, churches to be opened because of hardships, economic and moral. Let us all get to our churches and pray. The other names you see featured there, 56 of them, now, we're pretty proud of those fellows. But when they signed their name, actually July the 2nd, 1776, and then presented it, this is the famous painting by John Trumbull. This now hangs in the Capitol, U.S. Capitol. It's a huge, huge piece of artwork. And there you see people sitting around a room. Well, where is that? That is Freedom Hall now in Philadelphia. Seated in the gray hair, that's John Hancock. Why? Because he was the president of the Second Continental Congress. That's why. And the other gentleman sitting next to him is Charles Thompson. He's from Pennsylvania. He's the secretary of the Continental Congress. Well, who are the five fellows that are standing? I see $100 bill standing there. I mean, Benjamin Franklin. Closest to you is John Adams, the first vice president of the United States, and then the next president of the United States. Next to him is Roger Sherman of Connecticut. David Barton is going to talk in reference to this painting a time or two in his presentation this morning. Next to him is Robert Livingston of New York, tremendous legal mind. And then, of course, there's Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson and this group of five that was presided over by John Adams, they had about 17 days to draft some sort of official document because already the Battle of Lexington Concord had taken place. What was that about? That was your Minutemen. That was the Lexington Bridge and the shot heard round the world. The first shots of the American Revolutionary War. Who was that small band of British regulars? Why were they in Lexington Concord in the first place? They were sent to arrest somebody. John Hancock. And they failed and they were repulsed. A year in front of this painting, that began the American Revolutionary War. The Continental Congress said, hey, John Adams, put together four other fellows, and the Committee of Five was formed. Thomas Jefferson took about 17 days to draft the original Declaration of Independence, presented it to the Committee of Five, and then to larger members of Congress, and then finally, in Freedom Hall, July the 2nd, 1776, there they are giving the Declaration. 2 days later, it was signed on the 4th, 1776. With that in mind, we're going to go about 41 minutes of David Barton. So let's go ahead and dim our lights.
Come on, brother.
Thank y'all. Good to be with you. This is a time to remember, to look back. It is a reminding time. And so I want to do that. As we look at the country and who we are as a people, we've had 235 birthdays. We're just a matter of just a few weeks away from another birthday, 236. And we have been a blessed people. And part of why we've been blessed and part of what's shaped who we are as a people literally is the Bible. The Bible affects us in ways we don't even recognize today, including the way we speak. Do you know that we have 257 idioms, that is, phrases that we use in English language that come directly out of the Bible? Phrases that we use all the time today that we don't even think about being from the Bible. Look at these Bible phrases, direct quotes out of the Bible. By the skin of your teeth, handwriting on the wall, from the cradle to the grave, a leopard can't change his spots, there's nothing new under the sun. Signs of the time, a thorn in the flesh, a fly in the ointment. 257 phrases like that are direct verses out of the Bible. Now, next time you go to Walmart and you hear somebody use one of these phrases, you need to stop them and say, hey, do you know what Bible verse you just quoted? And they won't have a clue what Bible verse was that. Same when you get into areas of literature and fine arts. I think we all know who Shakespeare is. 400 years ago, he did all these comedies and plays and tragedies. And even now, 400 years later, Hollywood is still cranking out movies that are nothing but remakes of Shakespeare plays. We have Broadway plays that are done Shakespeare. We have high school groups that do Shakespeare. Do you know in Shakespeare's plays and his tragedies, comedy, his dialogue has 2,000 Bible verses in his dialogue. I'll guarantee a lot of folks on Broadway who do Shakespeare every night have no clue that they're reciting so much of the Bible every night as they speak, but they are. It's just that we're not aware of the way the Bible has shaped us in a lot of ways. I love the way that President John Quincy Adams said this. President Adams said this. He said, with regard to the history contained in the Bible, it's not so much praiseworthy to be acquainted with it as it is shameful to be ignorant of it. See, today, if somebody knows the Bible, we praise them. We say, that's really good. Back then, if someone didn't know the Bible, they would go, shame on you. How can you be a literate person and not know the Bible? See, it's such a reversal of the way that we look at things today. We need to go back the other way, where that everybody knows the Bible. Matter of fact, let me show you some incidents out of history that we don't think about that are maybe associated with the Bible. You're all aware of Patrick Henry, and Patrick Henry, that famous speech he gave, "Give me liberty, give me death." He gave March the 23rd, 1775. Let me just read you the last part of his speech. And this is St. John's Church in Richmond, and he's talking to the Legislative Assembly. He says, "Sir, we're not weak if we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature has placed in our power. The millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as that which we possess are invincible by any force which the enemy can send against us." He said, "Besides, sir, we should not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It's to the vigilant, the active, the brave." He says, "The war has already begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Gentlemen may cry, 'Peace, peace,' but there is no peace. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." What I just read to you is the last part of the speech. That's 14 sentences. Here's a question I've got. Those 14 sentences I just read, how many Bible verses did Patrick Henry quote? Any idea? He quoted 11 Bible verses in what he just read. Now, most of us saw that, and we didn't recognize these 11 verses, direct quotes out of 11 different verses that he used in giving that speech, but that's how much the Bible inculcated the way they talked, the way they thought, what they did, even in ways that we don't recognize today. Same way, take Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, a very notable founding father, one of only six who signed the Declaration and the Constitution. But I want to show you something that happened at the Constitutional Convention. This happened in 1787. We have the 13 states that have come together. They're trying to figure out how to have a federal government. The problem is they all come, everybody's got their own plan. You had the New York plan, you had the New Jersey plan, the Connecticut plan, the Virginia plan, and obviously the other states didn't want the plan of some particular state, and so it was falling apart. So on Thursday, June the 28th, 1787, Benjamin Franklin gave a speech at the Constitutional Convention, his longest speech. The convention's falling apart. Alexander Hamilton, they're heading back home to New York. He's tired of fighting with the other delegates. George Mason of Virginia, he's out of there because he's tired of fighting with the other delegates. And at this point, Franklin is 81 years old. He is by far the elder statesman of that group. And this is what he tells them. He's talking to George Washington, president of the convention, addressing the president. He says, "In this situation of this assembly, sir, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection." Now, 11 years earlier, this is the room in which they met and signed the Declaration of Independence. At that time, the Continental Congress, one Congress, had two chaplains. They prayed every day. They had serious prayer every day. I'll show you later how serious they were in their prayers. But he said, "Hey, we used to pray all the time in this room. And God answered our prayers. As he said, our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers were heard, and they were graciously answered." He continues. He said, "All of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. And have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance?" He said, "I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men." He said, "If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." He said, "I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel, and we shall become a reproach and a byword down to future generations." He closed. He said, "I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business." Now, 14 sentences long. Same question. How many Bible verses did Franklin just quote in those 14 sentences? And the answer is 13. He had direct quotations out of 13 different Bible verses in what he just did. But again, we're not used to seeing the Bible in that format. I'll give you one other example. I want to take you to George Washington in 1790, because now he's president of the United States. And by the way, George Washington says that after Franklin's call to prayer at the convention, They recessed for 3 days. They went to church. They specifically went to the church of Reverend William Rogers, who had a special time of prayer over the convention, prayed that they would get their heads together and come together in unity and produce something fruitful for the nation, and they did. So he's now the president, and he's on a tour of the 13 states. And as he's going from state to state in 1790, he's going into Rhode Island. And as he's going into Rhode Island, the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, writes him a letter in anticipation of his visit. And it's a letter of praise. They say, man, we think God's raised you up for such a time as this. You have protected our civil liberties. You protected our religious liberties. You're a man of God for the hour. And so he writes them back a very kind letter, responding to their kind letter to him. And this is part of what George Washington said to the Hebrew congregation in Newport. He said, may the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. He said, may the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness in our paths, and make us all in our own several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way everlastingly happy. That is two sentences out of the letter. In those two sentences out of the letter, how many Bible verses did he quote? Answer is 10. That letter was nothing more than one Bible phrase after another that he had put together. You see, that kind of understanding, incorporation of the Bible into their thinking and life is exactly why when you look at the Constitution today, if you know the Bible, you find Bible quotes all over the Constitution. Now people, oh no, it's a godless document, it's a secular separation of church and state. Sorry. If you know the Bible, you see the Bible all over the Constitution because there's exact direct wording that they use phrase after phrase. See, and that's what has produced so much of the nation. Now, we don't recognize that anymore, but it's good to go back and remember this. And as a matter of fact, we used to know this in previous generations. I love the way that President Andrew Jackson said this. He says, the Bible is the rock on which our republic rests. We knew that. We knew where the ideas came from. We knew why we were a unique nation. Here we are today, and we do enjoy a lot of blessings in this country. The form of government we have, our declaration, our constitution, we've been under that longer than any other nation has been under their form of government. As a matter of fact, there's 192 nations in the world today. And you look at those 192 nations, and that number goes up and down every year. It depends on who's had a revolution. Sudan just split, so now there's Sudan and South Sudan, which is the Christian part. You got 192 nations. We're the only one that's been under the same piece of paper for 235 years. In the period of time that America has had our constitution, France has gone through 15 constitutions in that same period of time. How would you like to live in a country where you've had 15 constitutions while we've just had one? Or you jump over here to Poland. Poland's had 7 constitutions since 1919. You can be alive in Poland today and live through 7 revolutions in your life. Russia's had 4 constitutions since 1917. Go further right off to Afghanistan. Afghanistan's had 5 constitutions since 1923. Everybody else in the world seems to live through a revolution every 20 to 30 years. We've had one revolution in our history. That was 235 years. We're more stable than any nation out there. You know what? We're also more prosperous than any other people. America's a small country. We have 4% of the world's population. That's just not that much. But that 4% produces 31% of the world's gross domestic product. 31% of the world's wealth. We don't produce more wealth because we actually have more natural resources, because we don't. South America's got more natural resources than we do. Africa's got more natural resources. We just seem to be able to take what we have and make it go further than anybody else. We're a blessed people. This is why we have the phrase attached called American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism is a phrase that was given to America back in 1831 as a foreign observer, elected to Tocqueville. He came here, he toured America, he said, this is unbelievable, I've never seen this stuff before. He said, I don't think any other nation will ever get to what America's done. That's where we get the term American exceptionalism. Now, if we cover this in textbooks today, we say, well, now, students, well, who are the leaders responsible for what we enjoy today? And invariably, we'll say, you got George Washington, of course, you got Thomas Jefferson, and with addition to Thomas Jefferson, you got John Hancock. And don't forget John Adams. And so we go through all these names, and that's great. No problem with that, because they are very significant guys who made a lot of contributions. But interestingly, 200 years ago, when they were asked who's behind American independence, they gave a whole different set of names than what we talk about today. For example, 1816, John Adams is an old man. It's 40 years after the American Revolution. We have a whole new generation of Americans who've come along. They're loving what they've got. They go, where'd all this come from? So 1816, 40 years later, you want to know where it came from? He said, well, if you want to know who's responsible for this, he said, right up top, you have to have the Reverend Dr. Samuel Cooper. And of course, there's the Reverend Dr. Jonathan Mayhew, and don't forget the Reverend George Whitfield. Oh, and there's the Reverend Charles Chaunt. And he goes through and starts listening to all these preachers. Now, today, we might know something about Whitfield, but the chances that we know anything about Cooper or Mayhew or Chaunt, slim to none. We don't study them today, but he said these are the guys responsible. See, we don't study these guys, and like, who in the world is Richard Allen, or who's Absalom Jones? Who's John Morant? Who is Lemuel Haynes? All these preachers, black and white, that had a huge impact in the American founding, we don't study them today. Take this preacher. This is Harry Hoosier. Harry Hoosier was a preacher in the First Great Awakening. He was there with George Whitfield, remember the Wesleys, Bishop Francis Asbury, Richard Cook, all these famous guys in the 40-year revival we call the First Great Awakening. He actually drew larger crowds than famous folks like Francis Asbury. We hear nothing about him today. Signer of the Declaration, Benjamin Rush, went and heard him preach. He said, he is the greatest orator I've ever heard in my life. Well, you've heard Patrick Henry, and you've heard Thomas Jefferson. You've heard, no, he's the greatest orator I've ever heard. Now, Harry Hoosier, does the name Hoosier sound familiar to anybody? Anybody recognize the name Hoosier from anywhere? I wonder how many people in Indiana know they've been named after a black evangelist. Probably very few. How'd they get that name? Real simple. You see, he preached all over the wild frontier area. Wild frontier back then was Indiana and Ohio and Kentucky and Tennessee. And as he preaches all these wild crowds out there, they come to Christ. Their life gets changed. Their behavior gets changed. They get really converted. And people look at him and say, look at him. He's one of those Hoosier guys. His life's been changed by the preaching of Harry Hoosier. That's how they got the name, Hoosiers, because all these people whose lives had been touched by his preaching. We don't hear these kind of things today. Now, going back to John Adams, why in the world would he point to a bunch of preachers and say, these are the guys responsible for what we enjoy today? It's real simple. When you look at the Declaration of Independence, it gives 27 reasons that we separated from Great Britain. As you read the reasons, it sets forth all these rights that have been violated. And historians have pointed out that every single right that's set forth in the Declaration of Independence had been preached from the American pulpit prior to 1763. You know what that means? That means the Declaration of Independence is nothing more than a list of the sermons we've been hearing in church for the last 20 years leading up to the Revolution. See, that's what the founders knew, and that's why they could point to these preachers and say, these are the guys responsible. Now, the 56 individuals who put this document together, the signers of the Declaration, if you look in the records of Congress, the first time that they ever got together is recorded in the records of Congress. It's September the 7th, 1774. And you read the records of Congress, and if you'll read the first time that all the founding fathers, first time we had a Congress, first time we got together, you'll read and you'll say, oh, look, they opened with prayer. And you'll keep reading and you'll say, wow, that wasn't a dinky little prayer, was it? According to historical records, the opening prayer session in Congress ran for right at 2 hours. Now, that's an interesting way to start anything. You know, church would be fun if we started 2 hours of prayer. We don't do that. But Congress started with 2 hours of prayer. And they didn't just start with prayer. John Adams over here said more. He wrote his wife Abigail and said, Abigail, not only do we have prayer, we studied 4 chapters of the Bible that morning in Congress. He said, God so spoke to us out of Psalm 35, just changed our whole attitude. Built our Psalm 35? Yeah, this is what he told Abigail. He said, Abigail, he said, I must beg you to read that psalm. Read the 35th psalm to your friends. Read it to your father. Abigail, we had prayer this morning, then we studied 4 chapters of the Bible, and man, you ought to see what God showed us in Psalm 35, and I want you to read it, then I want you to show it to your friends, I want you to show it to your father. Her father was the pastor of their church, Reverend William Smith. He wanted everybody to know what God had shown them out of Psalm 35, and we didn't even know they had a prayer meeting, much less a Bible study, much less God spoke to them out of the Bible study, but it didn't stop there. He said, Abigail, he said, in addition, he said, we have appointed a continental fast. He said, millions will be upon their knees at once before their great creator, imploring his forgiveness and blessings, his smiles on American counsel and arms. He said, can you imagine the impact of having 3 million Americans pray and fast? That's how many we had in America back then, 3 million. Now, it's interesting. We had this day of prayer and fasting. That was the first of 15 times that the National Congress called we the people to prayer. 15 times they did this national prayer. These guys were so into prayer that by the time you get to 1815, there have been 1,400 government-issued calls to prayer. 1,400 times. government's called us to prayer by 1850.
You've been listening to Pastor Steve Hadley of Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. Services are Wednesday evenings at 6:30 and Sunday mornings at 10:30. Pastor Steve encourages you to follow Acts chapter 2, verse 42, Word, Worship, Prayer, and Fellowship every day. If you'd like to hear today's message in its full, unedited form or view the verse-by-verse teachings from Pastor Steve, visit harvestreno.org. That's www.harvestreno.org.
How marvelous, how wonderful is my Savior's love for me.
May the Lord bless you and keep you as we are washed by the water of the Word.